Matan Koch learned at a very early age that the key to succeeding with his disability was to focus on the many abilities he was given, not the things he was unable to do. This hour, disabilities in the workplace. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Matan Koch has cerebral palsy. He's now a prominent disability rights attorney working to maximize the value of people with disabilities. He's speaking tonight at Coe College. Before talking with Koch, we'll learn about the Iowa Job Honor Awards, which recognize Iowans who have overcome significant barriers to employment. And we'll talk with some of the award's recipients. That's all coming up. First, a look at this hour's news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Iowa Job Honor Awards. It's an annual awards event that celebrates Iowans who have overcome significant barriers to employment and honors the employers who hire them. Previous honorees have overcome physical and mental disabilities, criminal convictions, limited English proficiency, and also long-term unemployment in their struggles for employment. The Iowa Job Honor Awards is now accepting nominations for its second annual awards event, which will be held in June of this year in Bettendorf. This hour, we want to talk with the awards director and several past honorees. Let's start by talking with Kyle Horn, who is in our Ames studio, founder and director of America's Job Honor Awards. Kyle Horn, welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It's only in its second year, a new event, a new award. You have aspirations for this event to spread to other states. Why start the Iowa Job Honor Awards?
Well, I saw a significant need for such a program when I was at work as branch manager of Manpower, staffing and recruiting firm in Ames, Iowa, a couple of years ago. And that really opened my eyes to the realities of the Iowa workforce. It introduced me to a large segment of our society that was struggling with a variety of barriers to employment. So I had made a mental note. I wanted to do whatever I could to help them enter the workforce and excel there. And a few months later, came up with the idea for the Job Honor Awards.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the economics of employing disabled people in terms of the opportunities we may be missing, as you referred to there in Iowa, because of the way we currently view disabilities in the workplace.
Absolutely. The Job Honor Awards does not advocate for the indiscriminate hiring of candidates who have barriers to employment. We recognize that unless and until an individual has taken steps to overcome their barriers, they probably remain unemployable. But our premise is simply this, that an individual who has been trained and vetted by a reputable workforce development agency represents no greater risk of turnover than a member of the general populace, and indeed probably less, owing to the intense scrutiny and training that they've undergone. But currently in the state of Iowa, with our very low unemployment rate, we can make a rock-solid mathematical argument that employers should indeed be taking a hard look at individuals who have barriers to employment. We refer to it as Iowa's great untapped workforce, and unless Iowa employers are going to be looking out on half-empty production floors or half-empty contact centers in a few years, we need to get creative, and it's time to give serious consideration to such candidates.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are, of course, a number of employers listening to this very broadcast who would have hesitancy to hiring someone with disabilities. What are the things you say to these people?
You know, I point out that I've been a hiring manager, and I fully recognize that it's the duty of the hiring manager to reduce risk for their organization. And the hiring manager's axiom typically is the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. But the potential tragedy of that approach is it overlooks those individuals whose lives are demonstrably on a new trajectory. They tend to be shackled to their past like a ball and chain. People who have prior criminal convictions, who have taken measures to overcome those patterns of failure, we need as a society to give them a chance. Individuals who have learned to manage whatever physical or mental disability they struggle with, they need to be given a chance in the workforce. So one of the interesting components, our honorees on the employer side of the fence all state to a person that these are not charity jobs. These individuals whom they've hired are making a wonderful contribution to the workforce. They tend not to have a sense of entitlement that we so often see in members of the population, but rather a sense of gratitude and appreciation and a remarkable work ethic. So they're improving productivity. They're raising the morale of the organization across the board.
Okay. Kyle Horn is founder and director of America's Job Honor Awards, talking about the annual awards event, only the second one coming up in June. They're accepting nominations right now. Let's meet some of the honorees from last year's event. David Dingman is with us. He's the owner of T&D Repair. That's a car repair facility in Burlington, Iowa. David Dingman in our Iowa City studio. Hello, David.
How are you today?
I'm fine. You've got an interesting history. Congratulations on this award from last year.
Why, thank you.
You come at it from a couple different angles. You have an injury yourself and then employ people who have limitations. Tell us a little bit about your injury and how that injury influenced the way you hire or changed the way you hire and handle employees.
Yeah. 15 years ago, I received an on-the-job injury that ended up causing me to have a total body disability. I could no longer perform my duties as a mechanic. You know, we work on heavy equipment. And so in the process of going through the rehabilitation and the therapy, I met Linda Hall with Workforce Development. And she's basically worked with me until I got to where I could become more productive in society, get back to an occupation. Between retraining and therapy, they got me to where I could return to the workforce. But I found a very unwelcome workforce. I was unable to secure a job because of my disability rating.
What would happen when you would apply with it for a job?
You just get blown off. You know, you could tell as soon as they met you and they read your file that, oh, well, you know, we're really looking for 100%, you know. You never got a call back.
Okay.
But I knew I was very well qualified in my field. So I decided that I would just open up my own company because I knew I could hire myself. Mm-hmm. And it's turned out real well.
When did you start that company?
10 years ago.
10 years ago. So tell us about some of the people that would fall into this category, people with limitations, the type of people. How many people would you say how many total do you employ, first of all?
14.
14. And how many of those would you say would be overlooked if you were, if they were looking for jobs at a traditional place?
Perhaps? A little more than half. Mm. In our typical, we see a lot of vets coming back, either with missing a limb or needing a special animal to help them with their job qualifications, or we see some recovering alcoholics or some people with mental disabilities, you know, that just need some more attention or just a hand up to get back into the workforce. And I found them to be by far very employable. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of my best employees have come to me with limitations or a disability, and I've gotten accustomed to giving everybody a chance. Mm-hmm. I found that if you give everybody a chance, even if they don't interview well, if you give them a chance, they'll most likely surprise you.
How do you, as an employer and owner of a repair shop, how do you have to approach these people differently when you're hiring? Can you give any advice to employers out there who are perhaps saying, you know, why not give it a try, but what are the things to watch out for to treat differently, or do you treat differently?
Well, I've come to the conclusion that when you're interviewing somebody with a disability, it's usually better to bring them in for a hands-on interview instead of just sitting at a table for a 20-minute interview about what you can and can't do and what your experience is. I usually tell them to come in for a day or two and show me what you know. Mm-hmm. Show me what you can do. And usually you'll be surprised between the difference between an interview and after they get to be more comfortable with you or the work environment on how well they can actually perform their job duty.
Can you give me an example or two of employees you have right now who have limitations?
Yeah. One of my longest standing employees is mentally challenged. And the first week was a little rough until he got things down, but he's by far one of my most dedicated employees, and you couldn't find anybody to do the quality of work that he does on a day-to-day basis, because honestly, the job's a little monotonous, but he loves it, and it fits him well, and we work back and forth together, and now I can ask him to do absolutely anything, and he's more focused at what he does because he knows he has limitations.
You say you employ vets as well. Certainly a lot of vets returning from our wars looking for employment.
A lot of times they come back with a low self-esteem. They don't feel like they can function back into the workplace, especially if they've had an injury, you know, or challenged in some form when they come back. And sometimes all they need is 6 months to a year to get to where they feel good about themselves. And the payback on that, you know, for helping out your community is incredible. Mm.
We're talking about the Iowa Job Honor Awards. It's in its second year. They're taking nominations. David Dingman is a recipient of the award from last year, the very first year, owner of T&D Repair, a car repair in Burlington. Also with us, Kyle Horn in our Ames studio, founder and director of America's Job Honor Awards. And we're meeting recipients of last year's awards so that we can learn a little bit about what Kyle Horn is calling. You're calling we're in need of a different type of hero, if I remember correctly from your website, Kyle.
Absolutely. Yes, our society tends to celebrate all the wrong kind of heroes, in my view. We celebrate lottery winners, rap artists, celebrities, and professional athletes, but seldom do we hear the stories of individuals whose lives are transformed by the hard work and perseverance that leads to meaningful employment. So, yes, that's our premise. We need a new kind of hero, and if society wants to reinforce an ethic, we need to celebrate that ethic, and that's what the Job Honor Awards is all about.
Megan Dawson is with us as well. Megan is in our Des Moines studio, a Des Moines resident who works at Hy-Vee there in Des Moines. Hi, Megan.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit about your disability.
Well, when I was born, I was in the womb too long, and they think that was a factor and from my disabilities and how I learned and grew up.
Mm-hmm. So you have a mental disability. You are now, I see from a video on the website, we want to get that website out there as well, jobhonor.org. All the recipients have a video dedicated to them where you seem to be blissfully happy at Hy-Vee today.
Yeah.
Tell us about what you did before starting at Hy-Vee.
Well, I had a few jobs. With my disabilities, I had a hard time getting a job. And then I found one, and it worked for quite a while. And then I lost support there, and people came and went, and I had a hard time fitting in. And then sometimes the jobs description I had wasn't what I ended up doing, and I got lost and didn't know how to do the job right.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying, it was a challenge to find, with your mental disability, a job that fit you, that suited you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do today?
I'm at Hy-Vee in the bakery, and I'm doing the cookies there and many other tasks in the bakery and some in the dishwasher and learning different things, how to cook.
Mm-hmm. How has this changed your life? Because anybody who's sought a job and has had frustration finding a job, knowing there must be something out there for me, people love to go to the workplace, have colleagues to work with. How has this changed you as a person to have a job?
It's changed me because I feel more independent and I can do a job and feel confident in myself and just going from day to day.
Mm-hmm. Your bosses at Hy-Vee, was it as simple as someone there with the power to hire you, believing in you?
Yes.
That was it. That was it. How did that happen?
It took a quite a practice, but I had a strong support system, and then I was able to build the confidence and get the award.
I understand you work in your church as well. You do some teaching.
Yeah.
Well, stay with us, but congratulations on the Iowa Job Honor Awards from last year. That must make you feel great. And I wonder if you go to work now at Hy-Vee in the bakery there with a different sort of feeling than you did before.
Yeah.
You do. Let's talk with another recipient, another honoree of the Iowa Job Honor Awards. These are awards for Iowans who have overcome significant barriers to employment and also awards for employers who hire them. Yvonne Rodriguez is with us, joining us by phone. Yvonne, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, Yvonne. You are working in Sheldon. What do you do there now?
I work at the Eye Care Center in Sheldon, and I'm the optometric assistant. I do their testing and help out with their contact.
You have a different story of a limitation that you overcame. You became homeless. How long were you homeless?
It was from, I would say, 6 to 8 months.
6 to 8 months? And yes. How did you become homeless?
We went, I lost my job, and then I went staying from house to house with cousins, and then I would just stay at the park, and then, yeah, it was just hard raising two little girls at the time.
Right, I understand. You have two children.
I have three now.
You have three children, and at one point you lived out of your car with your kids?
Yes, we would stay at the park.
I would call
it camping.
Must be a tough life. Now, where was the turning point for you? You're not any longer homeless. You and your kids have a home. Where would you identify the turning point being?
It was moving back to Iowa. In Texas, it was just hard living. Coming back to Iowa helped a lot. It was, you know, being bilingual, I could get different jobs everywhere. But my thing was going back to school and getting a career, because that would, you know, pay more. And that's what I did. And now I have a good title and a nice job.
Now, having been homeless, that must have been tough. Did you try to apply for jobs while you were homeless and get turned away?
I did. Maybe it was putting an address, just filling out an application. Not having a phone number to call me at when applying, I'll come in and check. It was hard. I mean, some people do need a steady place and a steady number, and employers do look for that.
How do you think you look at work and having a steady job and a place to live differently than others you may see around working perhaps in your office or in neighboring areas?
I think everyone is different. I do see people that appreciate what they have, and then I do see some that just don't know how hard it can get.
And you've been there.
And I've been there.
Kyle Horn, we've heard from three of these previous honorees. Let's talk a little bit more about if people are listening, they want to nominate someone. How do they do that?
Absolutely. We accept nominations through our website, jobhonor.org, and there are different buttons to press to nominate for the employee category and for the employer category. And we accept nominations through April 17th. Already we've seen some fantastic stories, and as you've heard from David, Megan, and Yvonne, we have some true heroes out there, and I think it's high time these stories are told. You also alluded to the fact that we've produced three-minute videos for each of these honorees. Those videos are deeply moving, and they are available on the website as well. When we premiered those at our inaugural awards event, it was the third and final day of the Iowa Association of Business and Industry's annual conference in Cedar Rapids in June of 2014. We were in the beautifully restored Paramount Theater. Several hundred Iowa business leaders, and there wasn't a dry eye in the house. I think people were really touched in the heart here, and what we're trying to do is awaken hope among job seekers who struggle with barriers to employment, and frankly, to awaken compassion among the employers so that they can recognize that indeed some people do change, not all, but some. And for those some who do, we need to honor them with a job.
You say compassion, but at the same time, you're saying this is not a charity handout.
That's exactly right. I knew going into this that we first needed to make the business case. Let's face it, companies exist for one reason only, and that is to enrich shareholder value. So unless and until we could make a solid business case, then all the moral arguments would fall on deaf ears. But we can make the business case in spades. The fact of the matter is, in Iowa right now, with a 4.2% unemployment rate, that equals about 72,000 Iowans who are unemployed. But we have more than 300,000 Iowans, adults of working age, who are not even counted in that number because they are neither employed nor actively seeking employment. Now, some of them are going to school or caring for family members. They're unemployed for perfectly understandable reasons. But a significant portion of that 300,000 plus are individuals who have simply given up looking for a job. It may be veterans having a difficult time acclimating to a civilian workforce, older Iowans encountering age discrimination, individuals with physical or mental disabilities that are easily managed with some modest accommodation, or it may be people with limited English proficiency. If we could engage just one-fourth of that 300,000 plus, we would more than double our supply of available workers in the state of Iowa.
Mm-hmm. We've heard about businesses getting on board with this idea as well. Yvonne mentioned your optometrist's facility there. We want to get their name out.
The Eye Care Center.
The Eye Care Center in Sheldon. Sheldon in the northwest part of the state. We mentioned Hy-Vee there. We mentioned also David Dingman of T&D Repair. And I sort of mischaracterized David's business beforehand. They don't fix cars. They fix heavy equipment, semi-trucks, and so forth here, too. Did you want to, Kyle Horn, mention some other Iowa businesses that you've seen as really reaching out, trying to transform themselves in the way they think about hiring people with limitations?
Absolutely. You know, our large employer category winner in 2014 was Winnebago Industries in Forest City, just doing a laudable job. And also, we've had great support. The Iowa Job Honor Awards would not exist without the help of Manpower and Manpower Group, which is helping us take this national, and also Central Iowa Works. They've been very generous and certainly have helped us move along. And we're excited about expanding nationally now.
Mm, yeah, tell us a little bit about that. So this expanding nationally, Iowa would be the birthplace of it, obviously. This is the only place it's happening right now?
That's right, and that's something about which we can all be proud. I think Iowa can be at the tip of the spear in demonstrating to the rest of the nation how to engage the untapped workforce. And based upon the marvelous reception we had in Cedar Rapids, I visited our corporate headquarters in Milwaukee, and Manpower Group, a Fortune 500 company, is very interested in seeing this go national. So we're rolling out the Wisconsin Job Honor Awards in addition to Iowa in 2015, and then a larger third tier of states in 2016.
When do you think, well, will you be in all 50 states soon?
That's certainly the plan and the vision. And, you know, I've got a pretty aggressive timetable for that nationwide rollout of 5 years. Some have told me it's overly optimistic, but we're going to aim high, and we're going to get there eventually.
Okay. Kyle Horn, founder and director of America's Job Honor Awards, a new type of award, only in its second year, celebrates Iowans who have overcome significant barriers to employment. And we've been talking with some of them today, also celebrating employers who hire these people with these barriers to employment. Tell us again, before we have to say goodbye, Kyle, how people can nominate businesses and individuals for
Certainly.
This award.
Please visit our website at jobhonor.org and complete a nomination form. And we'd love to hear the stories of your heroes.
Okay, thank you very much, Kyle Horn, David Dingman, and Megan Dawson, and Yvonne Rodriguez. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back after a short break, we're going to talk with Matan Koch. He learned at a very early age that the key to succeeding with his disability was to focus on the many abilities he was given rather than focusing on those things he was unable to do. Now he's a prominent disability rights attorney. He's visiting Iowa this week. We'll be back to talk with Matan Koch after a short break. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. So good to have you with us over the noon hour. This week, Texas Senator Ted Cruz became the first major party candidate to formally enter the 2016 presidential race. But how will he play here in Iowa? Tomorrow on this program, I'll talk with Dennis Goldford of Drake University and Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa about the Cruz candidacy. Find out why he's a darling of conservatives. Of course, it's Politics Wednesday tomorrow on the program. Today, exploring a couple of different perspectives on disabilities and disabilities in the workplace. My next guest is Matan Koch. He learned at a very early age that the key to succeeding with his disability was to focus on the many abilities with which he was blessed rather than focusing on those things he was unable to do. Now he's a prominent disability rights lawyer. He's spent his life working to maximize the value of people with disabilities. He's also a presidential appointee to the National Council on Disability. And this evening, Matan Koch is in Iowa to discuss the disability rights and awareness about them at Coe College in Cedar Rapids. He'll speak at 7 p.m. in Dow's Theater. Matan Koch, welcome to our program.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
You were born with cerebral palsy. That's a movement disorder. Tell us, if you could, about your first awareness of your disability and your awareness that you were different.
Well, it's interesting. I think that my first awareness that when I was different was when I actually had to articulate it. I was about 4 years old, and my parents, who were both Jewish professionals, were working at a summer camp, and I was asked to address the camp on, I think, what we then probably referred to as handicap, right? Disability probably wasn't even the word back then, and to talk about what life was like. And honestly, for the life of me, I couldn't understand the nature of the question. I mean, I knew that I was in a wheelchair. I wasn't, you know, blind to my own situation. But what I didn't know was why that was something worth talking about. And so while my parents were explaining that to me, I hit on the way that I'd always been raised to understand things, that we have things that we do well, that we have things that we do not so well, that at the time, you know, I couldn't move so well, and I had a brother who didn't speak so well, and we had our different strengths and our different weaknesses. And so when I said that to my folks, they said, so talk about that. And so I got up and I spoke to a group of a couple of hundred children in Massachusetts and said, everyone has a disability. And the way that I understood disability, which is to be some things that they don't do as well as other folks do it. And I think that guiding philosophy, you know, 30 years later still drives what it is that I do.
So that was really the origins of thinking about disabilities differently and a way to think about disability that you wish that the entire society thought about it.
Yes. I mean, I think that as a general rule, we gain so much more when we focus on people's positives, right? Nobody ever says, you know, I want someone with me because of this thing that we've identified as a problem. You say, well, they'd be a great friend. They'd be a great colleague. They'd be a great contributor to my business. And, you know, I want to meet them where they are and do what has to be done that they're able to contribute here. They're welcome here, whether the obstacle that they're facing is an identified disability or just something else that they need to meet. It could be a difficult commute. It could be childcare responsibilities. I basically think that if we can rearrange the paradigm that says we focus on the fact that we want people's talents, we want people's strengths, we want the things we value about each other, and we're going to do what we have to do to get them to us, the significance of those things that we've chosen to label disabilities changes.
Mm. Tell me on a personal level, when you meet someone who you haven't met before, how do you break through so that the person who has perhaps never had a friend or a colleague with cerebral palsy in this case, that you can break through and connect with them as a human to human rather than them seeing only the disorder that is apparent to them?
I think what I do is, not to sound simplistic, but I simply interact with them as I was already planning to. For many of them, hopefully who I am makes the impression, and whatever preconception they walked in with begins to fall away. For some, I'm going to miss that mark, and they're going to be really focused on the chair that I'm sitting in and not what I have to do. I think one of the big things that I had to realize was that my only responsibility and really the only thing that I can do is to fully be the person that I am and hope that they appreciate it. I can't take it upon myself to specifically break through any wall they might have, because then, believe it or not, I've made my disability just as central as they are, right? If I've focused my effort on breaking their conception, then I've made disability the center part of the discussion. And if I focus on what I bring to the table, you know, it's up to them to say, wow, he's such a good lawyer. Oh, yeah, by the way, he's in a wheelchair. Or,
right.
Wow, those stories he tells. He's in a wheelchair.
Do you see, though, that if the disability is preventing some communication or is a distraction, do you just address it head on to get it out of the way?
Well, if it's very clear that they're focused, then I might address it head on. I mean, usually with adults, to be honest, it's harder to tell. But what I love is kids. I love kids who walk up and they're clearly just curious because I look a little different, the chair's a little different, and my hope is that they will be encouraged to ask questions. I love to discuss with them frankly what I am and what's different, because kids learn by experiencing the different and making it the same. And the honest answer is, yes, I would love to do the same thing with adults. As a practical matter, you won't often have that opportunity because most adults have been socialized that I'd really be guessing if I wanted to determine that the wheelchair was the reason. Maybe they just don't like talkative, you know, New York guys that come in and dominate conversation. So I wouldn't necessarily want to presume that the wheelchair is why I've rubbed them the wrong way, unless they come right out and say, you know, tell me more about what it's like to be in a chair. And then in that case, I'm perfectly happy to address their questions openly, because we only change folks' conceptions if nothing is taboo, right? There's nothing wrong with the fact that I'm in a wheelchair. It just is. And, you know, so there you go.
Mutan Koch is with us, if you've just joined us. He's a prominent disability rights lawyer. He happens also to have, as we've been hearing, cerebral palsy. You attended Yale University, a president of the student disability community there, and reading about you, you worked with the office of the president of that university to modernize, to do some things differently, to help students with disabilities. And in a citation in your graduation, the university said, quote, "He did more than anyone in recent memory to raise awareness about disability. He has our admiration and gratitude for making Yale a more inclusive community." I'm wondering, at the beginning of that, since you evidently brought so much change to Yale, how much resistance? Can you remember resistance you faced and the type that you faced when you first arrived and saw some things that could really be markedly improved?
Actually, the interesting thing is it was quite the opposite, which is to say, I arrived at Yale really focused on some of my other student activities that I was really going to be excited to do, Jewish leadership, other things, and I was really pulled by certain members of the staff to say, we need a student to get involved with disability. And then, so I start, and I almost reluctantly acquiesced to do it because I was the only person positioned to at that time, and I was going to do it for a short period of time. And then I started to notice problems. And then the strangest thing happened. I had begun to make a list of problems. And then we're going to jump back in time for a second. At the very beginning of freshman year, the university had taken a publicity photo of me with the president to showcase the school's diversity, right? It was a simple diversity publication. They wanted to rerun it at the beginning of my sophomore year when I'd taken on the position. I said, no, not unless I can meet with the president to discuss the issues that we're having and what needs to change. What shocked me is not only was he immediately willing to sit down, but he immediately became a truly eager ally for change. Were there individuals that were resistant, faculty set in their ways, people protecting a few fiefdoms? Sure, but one of the things that I'm really grateful for is that from the moment that I reached out in a somewhat forceful fashion, the Yale administration was really a willing partner to make change. They didn't necessarily know how, and we walked that road together, but they were always a willing partner to do it.
Well, list some of the problems that you saw there that you could correct.
Well, the single biggest problem was that centralized, structured handling of disability had broken down, which is to say, way back when the Rehab Act had been passed in 73, this university had established a disability office, but that office was totally divorced by the time I got there from the president's office, from the provost's office, from the dean's office. So whatever they wanted to do with disability, they didn't have the ability to affect. They could persuade, they could cajole, they could talk to people. The single biggest thing we changed was to empower both the students and staff working on disability, say the president supports this, the dean supports this, the provost supports this, we're going to make a change. When there were recalcitrant faculty, we were able to say, sorry, this is university policy, we're going to change. When there were university policies that were simply outdated, it was no longer that we would work with someone in middle management until we found someone who could change the policy. We could go to the president's office and say things like, you know what? You know, this accommodation, I admit 20 years later, it's hard to remember specifics, but this accommodation or that accommodation should really be provided by Yale. And rather than having to convince someone in middle management that that was a good idea, we had folks at the top. So I would say if there's one thing we changed, it's that we got everyone together so that we could get the roadblocks out of the way. And then the second thing that we were lucky to do is it happens that early on in my tenure, the disability coordinator who was there when I arrived moved on to pursue other things, and I was able to participate in the hiring of a truly dynamite disability professional who's there to this day. And again, through a combination of fixing the lines of communication, getting her office the power and the prestige and the resources that it needs, we really moved change through. By rationalizing the more than $2 million per year that Yale was spending on physical accommodations so that there was a coherent accommodation plan. I mean, sort of the big things that we did just to make it so that Yale was moving forward mm-hmm. in a thoughtful way.
Mm-hmm. Now, after graduating from law school, you spent years in the general counsel's office dealing with legal matters at Procter & Gamble. What disability issues did you face there? What were the challenges that you tackled?
Well, the biggest challenge that we were tackling as a company was how do we make it a better place for employers, for workers with disabilities, and how do we attract more customers with disabilities? And again, one of the things that was great about P&G was that was a huge focus. It was something they wanted to do, but I was privileged to work with them to figure out how to do it, my primary role, to be clear, was as a counsel to the advertising division. I was working on a lot of standard legal issues, but I also served as counsel to and on the disability task force. And again, what we were really working on is how can we make this, a more successful place for employers, and then what would be the next steps to really win the consumer with a disability. And unfortunately, you'll see if you have my resume in front of you, personal circumstances were such that I could only stay there for a couple of years, but I'm pleased to say that P&G continues to work hard on these issues even today.
Disability rights lawyer Mutan Koch is with us, speaking tonight at Coe College in Cedar Rapids. Now, when you consult with your law firm on issues of disability or advise organizations, what do you find? What is really at the root of the most common misconceptions that you as a disabled person encounter, that others who are disabled encounter when we go try to seek employment, for instance?
Well, I think the two biggest misconceptions are, one, that it's going to be expensive, and two, that it's about dealing with things that folks can't do. So let's dispel the first one right away, and I feel like I have to do this with every client right when I start, right, is that research has been done by the U.S. government that tells us that something like 80% of workplace accommodations are free, and the vast majority of others cost $200 or less. So the notion that people with disabilities are expensive to accommodate is just wrong, but it's a huge barrier that people believe. And the other is that when you're focused on, oh, my gosh, how do we deal with a person's needs, it's a very hard discussion. People are often thinking in terms of what they can't do. If instead you can refocus the client to say, okay, we want this person to be the best lawyer that they can be. Here's the task that they're struggling to get done. Let's figure out a way to access that talent. It suddenly becomes very doable because the reward is not, gee, we dealt with this problem. It's, gee, we've unlocked this potential. And so I really try to focus the discussion that way, because things suddenly feel so much more doable.
Mm-hmm. You talk about something called purchasing power of the disability community. Is that what you mean?
Well, purchasing power is actually yet another thing. It's the simple fact that the U.S. Census Bureau released a number, and I have the exact number on my website, so if I get it wrong, but I believe they found that the total purchasing power of the disability community in the United States represents about $200 billion a year. So really what I was saying is that they should be being marketed to just like any other subgroup because they have an incredible amount of discretionary spend.
Mm.
And so it's nothing more than to say that, you know, I worked at the country's biggest consumer products manufacturer for a while. We segment by consumer group, and people should know that there's huge purchasing power for the disability world.
Are there companies or entities out there that are recognizing this better than others?
Well, I think Walgreens earned an early reputation for getting out ahead of the curve. I think that others are beginning to follow. I know that P&G is having the discussion internally. I think that, you know, I think there's a lot of internal discussion, but I'd love to see more of it expressed in the way people are externally developing, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. You spent almost 3 years, I understand, on the National Council on Disability. Politically, what are the major challenges you face as a member of that council?
Well, I think one of the biggest challenges is that everybody wants to do the right thing, but A, we're a little bit divided on what the right thing is, and B, this isn't going to come to surprise to anyone who follows the political world, we're in a massive financial crunch. So while disability isn't expensive, disability budgets often look like places that are ripe for cutting. And I got to tell you, it's really hard to talk about doing new and exciting things when you're also looking at 10 and 15 and 20% budget cuts. And I think that the secondary part is that, in large part, the government is one place where we could use to see more money spent on disabilities. Obviously, the government provides the safety net. The government is, you know, for many people with disabilities, a source of things that they can't get in the private sector. So a huge challenge that I often feel is it often feels like we were simply fighting a bit of a delaying action. On the one hand, we want to move forward with positive things. On the other hand, we're just trying to protect the important benefits that people with disabilities have, which is why, you know, even small victories like the ABLE Act that recently passed are just wonderful to have because they're steps forward, right? And I think that in this environment, any step forward is something to be celebrated.
We only have a couple minutes left, but tell us, what are the most hotly disputed cases or questions in the area of disability rights at the moment?
Well, I think the single biggest issue that has captured the headlines is the CRPD, the Convention on Rights for Persons with Disabilities, which is largely modeled after the ADA, but we're one of the only countries in the world yet to ratify. I feel like that's not only is that one of the biggest hot-button political issues in the disability community right now, I think it's one, you know, I seldom take strong positions in public fora, but I will say if there's one thing we might ought be a little ashamed of as a body politic, it's that we can't ratify an international statement of the same ideals that we've codified into law in this country. And but in terms of the biggest hot-button issue, and this ties so well into, I think, what your previous segment was on, although I wasn't privileged to listen, it's really jobs, jobs, jobs. We're all focused on the fact that even as employment bounces back for people without disabilities, the disability employment level remains abysmally low, and it's really a question of what can we do politically, what can we do practically to move that along, and it's an endless subject of discussion.
Okay, well, let's skip a few of the minutiae and jump into the future in this last minute. How do you hope future generations will look back at our time, considering the change you and others hope to bring about? Look back at our time in terms of how we view disabilities, attitudes towards disabilities.
I hope that we look back, and it seems anachronistic that we ever talked in terms of disability. I hope that we look back and or future generations look back and recognize the twist where we started taking each person as an individual customer and celebrating their strengths, where we really did have a universal inclusion that makes the label of disability seem as outdated as, you know, the class system of a previous century.
Mm. I was surprised a few years ago on this program interviewing a young man who had been born without any legs and asking him about this topic, and he didn't consider himself disabled. He considered society disabled for the way that it looked at him.
That's a common perception, and You know, I think that if we can get society to a place where conditions are not disabling, that is indeed the change that I would love to see.
And what are the levers? How does this change happen?
I really think it actually happens one by one on individual attitudes. I mean, the reason I've launched a national speaking tour and I'm actually taking time to go around and talk about it is I really think you need to change individual hearts one at a time, and each person changes the way we deal with each other. I don't think you can legislate this. I don't think it can be a policy initiative. I think it really needs to be a sea change in our behavior.
Okay. Matan Koch, thank you so much for joining us by phone in Iowa today, later this evening. I don't know if you're in Iowa yet, Matan.
I am. I'm actually calling you from Coe College.
Okay, very good. Well, tonight you're speaking at Coe College in Cedar Rapids, 7 p.m. in Dow's Theater. That's open to the public, no charge for that. Thank you, Matan.
Thank you.
Matan Koch is a prominent disability rights lawyer. He also has cerebral palsy. Tomorrow on this program, Politics Wednesday. Get excited for that because at the beginning of this week, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, you heard the news, became the first major party candidate to formally enter the 26th presidential race. How will he play in Iowa? We'll ask our guests tomorrow, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, not only about the Cruz candidacy, but also other items on our political landscape. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon. Also thanks to Julia Davis. In Ames, we had help from Garrett Van Leeuwen and John Pemble in Des Moines. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.